The gospel is Luke chapter 15, verses 11 through 32. Then Jesus said, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of the property that will belong to me.' So he divided his property between them. A few days later, the younger son gathered all he had and traveled to a distant country. And there he squandered the property in dissolute living. When he had spent everything, a severe famine took place throughout that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed the pigs. He would gladly have filled himself with the pods that the pigs were eating, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired hands have bread enough to spare? But here I am, dying of hunger. I will get up and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired hands.' So he set off and went to his father. But while he was still far off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. He ran and put his arms around him and kissed him. Then the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his slaves, 'Quickly, bring out a robe, the best one, and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet, and get the fatted calf and fill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to celebrate. Now his elder son was in the field, and when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. He called one of the slaves and asked what was going on. He replied, 'Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fatted calf, because he has got him back safe and sound.' Then he became angry and refused to go in. His father came out and began to plead with him. But he answered his father, 'Listen, for all these years I have been working like a slave for you, and I have never disobeyed your command. Yet you have never given me even a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came back, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him.' Then the father said to him, 'Son, you will always be with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice, because this brother of yours was dead and has come back to life. He was lost and has been found.'" The word of the Lord.
A while back, I read a book that was interesting to me, and I found out that while I was reading it, my niece was reading the same book. It was a retelling of some of the myths of the Norse gods. You know, and I'd heard of those gods, some of them, Odin and Loki and stuff like Thor, but I haven't really read some of their stories. And so I'm reading these stories, and I'm kind of texting with my niece about this. And at one point, I texted her, I said, "You know, the way these Norse gods act in these stories, they're kind of like adolescent boys. They're kind of goofy, they're kind of stupid, they're not all that bright. They're just playing pranks on each other all the time." And my niece texts back, she says, "You're absolutely right." She says, "I should know, I teach high school boys." And I thought, well, really? But then you look at the Roman gods, you look at the Greek gods, you look at the Egyptian gods, they're all kind of that way. They're not very elevated creatures. They're very ordinary, and they share very human failings like us. You know, many people have pointed out that even in many ways, the God of the Old Testament reflects that feeling too. In many ways, he's just kind of angry and punishing. I mean, there are very bright spots, and there's a whole thread of grace that runs through the Old Testament too. But in many places, that God that they looked at was kind of a disappointment. The trouble is, we assume that this is really the way God must be. this older way, and it has horrible consequences for how we understand God, for how we understand ourselves, for how we understand one another, right? These older gods, what was at the heart of what they were about? They were always so very, very concerned about their power. They were always so very, very concerned about their honor. And if they felt their honor was besmirched in any way, well, immediately they were angry. Immediately they were out for revenge. These gods were gods of judgment and control, and they were always aloof and apart. They're, you know, Valhalla or Mount Olympus or Asgard or wherever it is. Not a very pretty view of God. And if we're honest, a little too much of that view of God has crept into our understanding as well. When you look at if the gods are this way, then what does that make us? It makes our job one of appeasing, right? One of trying to bargain with these gods, to keep them happy, and we're willing to pay them off because we're so afraid of them, right? And we think if we get a little bit good at ingratiating ourselves with these gods, well, then we get all self-righteous, don't we? We're like, well, we're those gods' favorites, and other people are not. And a lot of that thinking creeps into how we relate to God, too. And that has consequences for how we view one another, for our neighbors, right? All of a sudden, you divide into groups. You know, are you with us or are you against us? Are you in the in-group or are you outside that? And we tend to think we're in competition with one another because there's scarcity. And we look at people who do things differently, and they don't just do things differently. Because they don't do it our way, they must be doing it the wrong way, which must mean they're bad people, even evil people, even worthy of punishment. And we end up wanting justice and fairness for us, but we are happy to ask God for punishment upon others. We heard it even in the psalm this morning. That's why it's fairly unique when Jesus comes along and reveals a different kind of God. A God whose primary quality is forgiving, and that changes everything. And we say, well, isn't God's primary quality love? Well, yes, but the way I look at it, forgiveness is the practical name of love, right? It's easy to love somebody, but to actually love somebody in this world, it looks like forgiveness, doesn't it? And this was the hardest thing for Jesus to convince us of, that God is a forgiving God. But if we accept Jesus' premise, well, that makes us radically redefine who God is, who we are, and who our neighbors are, right? You can look at forgiveness in many ways, but I think it all boils down to kind of just letting go. Just letting go of what? Of control, of your rights, of your self-righteousness, of fairness. Why? Why would we let go of those things? Well, because something is more important than that, and that is relationship. We empty our hands so that we can actually receive and give love. So how does this impact how we look at God? Who is the God that Jesus knew and loved and tried to present to us? It was a God who was so close and so caring and so desiring to be in relationship that Jesus could only call him Abba, which means Papa or Daddy, that term of intimate relationship and endearment. He wanted to make clear what he experienced in his own life, that God is always and only for us, always willing and able to pay the price to sustain that relationship with his creatures. And this makes for a radically different God. And that's the God we see in this famous, well-known parable of the prodigal son, right? This is a God who gives away his inheritance to the son simply because he asked. Now, that doesn't make sense in terms of any of our lives. Not at all, because for us, the inheritance is a limited resource. But why does the father in this story give away everything? Because that's what a father does, and he realizes his resources for his children and for himself are limitless. So he gives. He just freely gives, as God gives freely to us. Our lives, ourselves, our time, our possessions, our home, our families, our work, whatever it is, it's all gift. And it's always flowing toward us. Who is this God in the parable of the prodigal son? It's the God who is able to embrace this wayward and wandering son who has disobeyed, who has wasted his life, who has wasted his inheritance. He deserves nothing but a good, strong lecture and a time out, and maybe even separation from the family. But instead, this God runs out. Without even listening to any excuse or any apology, he embraces his son into the love and the life that the father can only give. And it doesn't end there. Who is this God in this wonderful, wonderful parable? When you think there should be a happy ending, the son that was lost is now found and restored to the family. Well, it isn't over, because the older son gets in a huff, gets in a snit, right? And he's jealous, and he's angry at his younger son, and he's angry that he's being forgiven and being welcomed back into the family. And so the father has to go out again. He has to go out and beg this son to come in. Because that's what he does. Because the relationship with his son is more important than anything else. You know, there's a very famous sermon preached in the early days of this country. It's called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. We had to read it in English class at one time. And the image was just so vivid. The pastor painted the image in this, that we are like a spider dangling from a little single silk thread, dangling over a huge flaming volcano. And if we didn't shape up and get right with God, God would snip that and we would fall into that burning hell. That is not the image that Jesus wants us to know from this parable at all. What Jesus wants us to know is the cry of the parable, the prodigal son, his own cry on the cross. It is, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. Well, if our God is a forgiving God, then it also says something about who we are. We are absolutely loved, not because we are so wonderful and lovable, but because God is absolutely love. I've talked about the Trinity. I see it more as a circle of love, a flow of love, that the Father pours out his love absolutely and infinitely to the Son. The Son pours it out absolutely and infinitely through the Spirit, and the Spirit pours it all back to God. I love that imagery, just a cycle of love, uninterrupted, absolutely free-flowing. And one of my teachers said to me, if that is indeed the best image that we have for God, this wonderful flow, uninterrupted flow of love, where is there room in that for anger? Nowhere. Where in that flow of love that is the very essence of God himself, is there room for judgment? Where is there room in that flow of love for hell? And yet sometimes we experience God as angry and judging, and we feel like we're in hell. It's because when you try and stand against the flow, then it's going to seem like opposition to you, isn't it? It's not because the flow isn't all love and all good. It's because you try and stand against it. A while back in the fall, right when the leaves were changing, some friends of mine, we rented some canoes, and we went north of town and south of Washburn there. You can put into the river. And it was a beautiful day, and the trees were all golden lining there. And we could just float down the river. We didn't even hardly have to paddle. The current would just carry you through. If you go with the current, life is wonderful. Last summer I went up to Alaska, saw the bears up there eating the salmon run. And the friends I went with, they wanted to go fish for salmon. And I thought, well, that wasn't even fair because you could just reach down into the river and grab them. But anyway, they wanted to go, but I didn't want to go fish for salmon. But I thought, I'm going to put on the waders and I'm going to go into the stream with them and just look at the salmon and look at the bears eating the salmon in the water there. So, well, my friends wanted to go upstream, and as soon as I got into that water, and it was waist deep and this current was flowing, I'm like, whoa, I'm not going anywhere. Trying to fight the current, I just about fell. It's not that the current itself is bad. It's the standing against it that makes God seem angry or judgmental. And until you experience that going with the flow, you won't know anything about the nature of reality. As I look back at it, the greatest moments of change in my life have come when I finally could experience this kind of love that God has been pouring out my way all the time. And as I look back in my life, pain and punishment and shame and guilt have never, ever moved me forward in my faith life. Only the drawing of love can do that. Only the drawing of love has allowed me to do that in my life. As I look back at everyone in my life who've moved me forward and showed me this love, it's always been God underneath that. The author C.S. Lewis, and his Chronicles of Narnia just made so clear that this is a loving God. Martin Luther just expanded my mind and made me realize that God is a God of grace. Father Richard Rohr just pushed me farther in that way. As I look back at the people who have touched my life with love, it's parents, it's my godparents, it's friends, it's the church, it's this church. You know, one of the quote, disadvantages of staying in a church for 33 years is that every 5 years I can't take my little bag of tricks and go to another church and dazzle them with this new, fresh, wonderful pastor who's got all these little things. Instead, I have to grow up and I have, you see me as who I am, with my good points, but my faults and my failings, fragility and my failings, and yet you accept me. And you love me, and you help me to grow. There it is. When we see that forgiveness is at the heart of the universe, it doesn't just change our view of God or ourselves, but as others too. You know, in this parable there, we see this poor older brother. The most wonderful thing has happened in his father's life and his brother's life, and it should be in his life. But there he stands, aloof and angry, because he thought that his father's love needed to be earned. And what a terrible thing to realize that that was the assumption that he was working under. If his father's love needed to be earned, think of this. It made his father into a monster withholding love. It made his brother into an enemy, competing with him for his father's love. It made himself into a loser. But how did the father deal with it? The way he dealt with everything. No judgment. He just pointed out the obvious, that it was all love, even for this older brother. He says, "You were with me all the time, and everything that I have is already yours." It's only an invitation into a renewed relationship. And the son denied himself all of this. When we don't forgive, we hold ourselves hostage, right? We hurt ourselves. Now, forgiveness doesn't automatically make everything right in our lives. And it doesn't mean you're going to automatically be in restored relationships with those who have hurt you or who you have hurt. And it doesn't mean that there aren't consequences to the stupid and foolish and hurtful things that we do, but it does mean that we can let go so that we and those who have sinned against us or we have sinned against can be free. And that letting go, that sharing of forgiveness, changes everything. Sometimes when I hear people talk about the challenges of their life, the cycles of brokenness and anger and hurt that they get caught up in. I just see God looking at them with infinite pity and saying, why is it so hard for you to let me love you? Why is it so hard for you to let me love your brothers and sisters in Christ? Let go of anything that's keeping you from experiencing that love and enter into my joy right here, right now. Amen.